yeah, lovely to see you all. And I was thinking when I was sitting there, oh, in a minute, it's a different perspective. You know, you're sitting down with everyone and then you turn around. But what, you know, lovely audience. Yes, yeah, and really appreciate what Ratna Ghosh was saying. And I was very, very moved by this clip, indeed. Okay, so, yeah, Manjushri is on the shrine. And I'm, yeah, and this talk is about Manjushri. And in a sense, they are the same, but there's just slight sort of differences. So I'll bring that out, I hope. So it's interesting giving this talk in the first place. I was thinking, well, why am I giving a talk on Manjushri? You know, that was a... and it's been quite an interesting process for me that's far more than about this talk. And so about a year ago, I was just considering entering into the precepting process. Just considering that. And I was walking along by the river and... for some reason, Manjushri came into my mind. And I thought, what's that about? You know, has this got something to do with this? You know, what is it? And so I was just a bit curious about it, really. So my own practice as an order member since I've been ordained, I've been practicing the Vajrasattva sadhana practice. And I feel I have a deep connection with Vajrasattva. At the moment, it feels a little bit more sort of tenuous or something because I haven't been devoting so much time to it. But certainly if I'm on a solitary or anything like that, I do a lot of Vajrasattva practice. I've got this deep commitment and relationship. So it was interesting then to be thinking, well, Manjushri, what's Manjushri trying to communicate? So that night I went home and I listened to a talk by Jnanavacharya. I went on Free Buddhist Audio and I thought, well, who's... spoken about Manjushri, and up popped Jnanavacharya. And I can't remember, it's something like the sword, the book and the sun, or something like that, and I listened to this talk. I don't know if I'd heard a talk of Jnanavacharya before, but it's really an excellent talk. He relates to Manjushri in terms of this film he's seen about a group of people who go off to try and reignite the sun with a nuclear thing. But the talk was absolutely excellent and it really sort of caught me. And also he's very humorous, so he laughs a lot. He's got this very lovely sort of laugh. Every now and again he'd burst into laughter. Anyway, so that was, you know, that's ages ago. And then Ratna Ghosh said to me, would I like to give a talk on Ratna Ghosh? And I suspect I'd have said yes, whatever the talk was, because I do. I often think afterwards, why do I do that? But I said yes, and I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because now I'm going to be thinking about Ratna Ghosh. Match Ratna Ghosh.
I know you think about me all
the time. I do. That's so funny, isn't it? That's probably going to happen again, isn't it? So he's been very sort of present in my experience, and I've been, you know, listening to more talks and just thinking about it, you know, what is this? So the thing that I thought I was drawn by was this gentle voice one. So that was what really, I love that, the gentle voice one. So Manjushri, gentle voice one. And I thought, oh, often, the number of times I think I say to people about, you know, when I hear them talking about themselves or their experience, I say, well, watch how you're talking about yourself or your experience, because sometimes there's a lot of harshness and judgment. And, you know, more and more I've thought the way we think about ourselves and the way we talk about ourselves, it's like we create ourselves in that. And often there's a lot of judgment around. So I'd often say this thing about, well, just watch, you know, try and reframe that. Just bring some kindness into your experience. you know, and try and understand more about the conditions that bring those things about. So I'd often say that. And I think that's arisen out of my own practice, and over time I've really, really done that. You know, I've had so much negativity towards myself in the past, and judgment and all sorts of stuff, and I've been working with it for years, and I really feel it's changed. So it doesn't mean to say I've totally eradicated it, but it's really, really changed significantly. So that, I think that was where I thought I was probably going to go with this. Yeah, talking, how we talk to ourselves, how we think, the quality of the tone of the thought. That probably doesn't make sense, but do you get what I mean? Like the quality of the thought and the tone of the voice. And I think as that happens, then the more we can do that for others, you know, we try, you know, just a way we communicate to others, just helping them think about, well, you know, talk about your experience. You can bring a lot of kindness into your experience. So I think it just sort of has this effect that goes on and brings that something very gentle and compassionate. If we can just sort of watch that. So speech is of great interest to me, a really, really significant interest. And I, you know, I love the fact that we have 4 speech precepts and as order members. And I can really tell by my speech what's going on in a way. And I want to tune into that more. I think preparing for this talk, I've been noticing more my speech and what happens when I either want something or I don't want something to be the way it is. So it feels very, very important to me. And I was thinking of like a speech, if we think of the Noble Eightfold Path. You know, you've got perfect vision and then you've got perfect emotion. And the next one that's talked about is perfect speech. You know, and this connection kept coming through around speech. How important speech is, and how easily it goes wrong. You know, it goes awry. You know, we say something out of a bit of irritation or something like that, and you know, and it affects us, and it affects other people. So that, yeah, the gentle voiced one. So that's a bit about my interest in doing the talk. And then I started really thinking about lineage, sort of, and that's been another sort of real interest for me over the years, is just thinking about how we come to be here today. You know, and I was thinking, about, when I was sitting down there, I was thinking, oh, all the conditions that came to me sitting down here, all the teachers, and going right back to the Buddha. You know, so I've been really reflecting on that. And so that's why we've got this figure on the shrine and at the back, and that is Jamyang Kyentse Rinpoche. So I was reading about him in Teachers of Enlightenment, written by Kulananda. So I looked him up because he actually gave Bante the practice of Manjigosha. So, and according to the book, Bante sees him as his root guru. And they met in 1957. And Bante asked to have the initiation into the Manjigosha practice. And Jamyang Kyentse Rinpoche gave him the Manjigosha practice and Vajrapani, Green Tara and Avalokiteshvara. So he gave him all of those teachings. They were communicated to him. And I was also interested that he commissioned a tanka for Bante. I didn't know about this. And on it, Bante's on the tanka apparently with 19 teachers, and he's on there at one point meditating in a cave, and on another point teaching the Dharma on this tanka. And Rinpoche explained to Bante that through this initiation, he had transmitted to Bante the essence of the teachings of all the gurus on the tanka. and that Banti was now their spiritual heir and successor. And I just thought it's really important to me, just recognising how the lineage, how these teachings come down to us. You know, how this teaching of Manjigosha was so important to Banti, and where it came down from. And then now coming down to us, and I was thinking about all the talks I've listened to, and Jnanavacha, Sangadevi, reading the Santra's book, Meeting the Buddhas Again. You know, that book has been, you know, just such a key book for me, and how that all comes into one, you know. And then I think, well, I'm here giving this talk based on all of these teachings that have been passed down. Yeah, all the conditions that came to bringing us here now, you know, I just find it really, really remarkable. Yeah, so Manjigosha, Manjushri, which we've been talking about, so both the synonyms for the same figure, I've said that. And Manju means gentle, and Gosha means voice, and Shri means auspicious. So it's either the gently voiced one for Manjigosha, and or the gently auspicious one for Manjushri. So there's these subtle differences. And they're from the Mahayana tradition. And a Manjigosha is said to be the archetypal bodhisattva of wisdom. So he's the bodhisattva of wisdom. And all of these figures are said to have emerged in people's meditations at different times. They're embodiments of aspects of the enlightenment experience. So Manjigosha being an embodiment of wisdom, whatever that means, you know, whatever that means. They're trying to communicate something in a particular form, you know, trying to communicate to us. So one of the things, like I was saying about Vajrasattva, when you really take on a practice or when you meditate on a figure, you enter into a relationship with them in a sense. A heart connection, you know, you start to enter that. So I've been starting to just enter into a relationship with Manjigosha, you know, just sort of, what does it mean to be in connection with Manjigosha? You know, what does it mean? What it be to taste the experience of the enlightened mind, you know, and of this wisdom aspect? What would that be like? So some of the symbols, you won't be able to really see that image properly, I think, but it's worth having a look at later. So one of the things about it is the colour. So the colour is usually this sort of subtle, a sort of orange. I think it was Sangadevi said it's like honey held up to the sun or something. If you imagine if you had a honey jar and you held it up to the sun. This is the colour of Manjigosha. And all these things are trying to communicate something. And I think, well, what does it communicate? You know, what is it about this colour? And I thought we can sometimes think of wisdom as something cold or, you know, like cutting through, like we might have thought about the sword, this cutting through. And I thought, and then you've got this colour, which is very warm, and it's soothing. I think it's soothing, and it's gentle, it's soft. You know, I think it's trying to get at something about, well, what is wisdom like? What is the texture of it? And I thought, oh yes, it's something about this, it's soothing, that for me. But we could reflect on the figure and just think, well, what does it say to me? You know, what does its colour mean? What does it suggest? And we need to bring our imagination into play, don't we? You know, just really sort of bring our imagination in. What does all this mean? So Manjigosha sits on a moon mat on a blue lotus, and he's sitting in a full meditation, full lotus position, meditating. free of the cares of the world, sitting on a lotus, just meditating. And lotuses, they symbolise purity of wisdom. You know, they grow out of mud, don't they? And, you know, it's very sort of muddy water. And then you have this magnificent flower that just stands above it. You know, I love all the where the Buddha talks about us all as like a lotus field. I know I've said that in our Mitra study group before. We're all like lotuses at all different stages. But here you've got Manjigosha sitting on this blue lotus. Yeah. And I was thinking of that expression. I think it is. It's like we're in the world but not of the world, or something like that. In the world but not of the world. That's what came to mind. And he's said to be youthful and beautiful, you know, 16 years old or something, and radiant, with black hair adorned with blue lotus flowers. And he wears the crown of the five jhanas, so he's got the different, the five Buddha mandala, so symbolising he has all those aspects of their wisdom as well. And, yeah, and what does it mean, like youth and beautiful? I suppose he's... this wisdom and this gentleness. It's very beautiful. You know, I think it evokes beauty. And I think it's something about seeing beauty from that wisdom or something. See beauty, see the beauty of all things. I think that's what it's trying to express. And then, of course, we've got the flaming sword of wisdom in the right hand. So when I first saw Manjigosha, that was the bit that excited me. I thought, oh yes, cut through the roots of delusion. You know, I you know, that was how I sort of saw it. I thought it was quite exciting. And yeah, but I was sort of interested in the whole thing around the voice as well, alongside the sword. So with the sword, it's said to be so sharp that if you held the sword out and you dropped a piece of silk, it would fall onto the sword and it would just go right through it. It's like this sort of sense of I can just get it. Can you? It's like what that would be like. It's effortless, absolutely so sharp. And it. And the sword is said to cut through all our wrong views, all delusion, all ignorance. It's just cutting through. But it's not having to hack at it. It's not like some sort of aggressive sort of hacking away. It's more like, this is it, or something. And, yeah. So that's the sword. And, of course, it's got the flames at the tips, you know, the flames. This is about transformation, transforming ignorance into wisdom. So again, it's not a cutting out in some sort of negative way. It's much more like you're transforming something, you're transforming energies into something very, very positive, into wisdom. And we can think about, well, what does the sword mean to us? You know, the figure, we could pay attention to the figure at some point, just reflect on it a bit. What's it saying? What does it say to me, you know, to us? And then we've got the book. So there's the book, which is Perfection of Wisdom. It's a Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. And either he holds it to his heart, if it's Manjigosha, so it's held to the heart, or it sits on another lotus, if it's Manjushri. That's what I think. I'm not absolutely certain of that, but I think that is the distinction. So with Manjigosha, he's holding the Perfection of Wisdom at his heart. So I'll just say a bit about the Perfection of Wisdom, because as I've been reflecting on the figure, this has more and more become the thing that is has caught my attention or my contemplation. So in the Hinayana, knowledge of reality consisted in seeing persons and things are broken down into what was called dharmas. We won't go into a huge amount about this. But whenever you look and analyse closely, you just end up seeing this impersonal flow of psychophysical processes, and they're called dharmas. So that was the Hinayana. And my understanding is that at some point, you know, from what I've been reading, is that these dharmas were taken literally as if they had some sort of existence as an ultimate reality in their own right or something. And so then the Mahayana were breaking them down, and resolving things down into everything is shunyata. So all things are shunyata. They're void of any independent, fixed existence. So that's the realm we're in with the perfection of wisdom. So the knowledge that all dharmas are shunya is what's known as pranyaparamita, so the perfection of wisdom. So I was thinking about that. So Manjigosha holds this text to his heart, one of the perfection of wisdom texts. And I was thinking, what does it mean to hold that to your heart, knowing the knowledge that all things are shunya, that everything's void of any independent fixed existence? What's it like to know that? And I was thinking, if you had it at your heart, it sort of expresses like something most dear. You know, I was thinking most dear are essence. It's like in your essence, it's in your very heart being. And if that was there, then every thought and every word and every action we ever did would that arise spontaneously out of that. So there'd be this sort of heart knowing, step for knowing, which informs everything then that you do. And so I think that's why I love this, holding it to your heart. And paramita means that which goes beyond all duality, all mind-made divisions. So we're into that whole realm. And we think of like the Heart Sutra, which is what we do in our puja. This is one of the texts. And it's the wisdom of enlightenment, seeing reality at all times, in all places, and under all circumstances. Seeing how things really, really are, knowing that deeply in your being, if we're Manjigosha. And then everything will be an expression of that, including, obviously, the speech. And I was thinking how then out of that arises this gentle voice. So for me, over time, just more and more, it's about this contemplation of these wisdom texts. So out of this deep knowing, I know Vasantra talks about knowing something in your bones. You know, we can know something intellectually, we can understand it at some sort of intellectual level, but somehow we've got to get it right into our depths. So out of the perfection of wisdom, this voice of Manjigosha. And he said to have a 64-fold voice or something, 64 qualities, and that are so gentle and pleasing that they can speak to everyone and to anyone. You know, that so it's like anyone could just hear it because it's just got all these qualities. Because sometimes we can hear some people and not others, can't we? You know, we don't really listen, but he can communicate to everybody. And this, you know, he's communicating about wisdom. So Banti says about wisdom subtle. He talks about it being like walking through mist, like osmosis, and like you could pick it up in a sort of osmosis way. And it can be waking up very gently and subtly. He talks about that. And he says the voice is also said to be as loud as thunder. And if we really hear it, it will shatter our illusions and wake us up from the kleshas, so from ignorance and hatred and, and what's the other one? Ignorance, hatred and
craving.
All the poisonous qualities. So the voice can also be loud as thunder. I think it's fascinating, isn't it? This gentle voice, and it can be loud as thunder. And that led me to think about the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. So Manjushri in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. Going to see Vimalakirti, when Vimalakirti's sick, the Buddha's asked somebody to go and see him, and Manjushri's the only one who's prepared to go, because everyone else is so sort of daunted by the level of Vimalakirti's wisdom. So Manjushri goes, and to bring it down into a tiny bit, the question is asked, how do you attain to the wisdom of non-duality? And Manjushri says, you can't say anything. As to say anything is to falsify what wisdom is. And then he asks Vimalakirti to comment, and then Vimalakirti said to just, there's just this thunderous silence. Nothing can be said. And Bhante, because I was reading this from Bhante, and he was saying that Manjushri has the last voice before silence. It's the last sort of word on wisdom before silence. Because you can't communicate wisdom via concepts. We try, and that's what we need to do, but we can't do that. So one of the things about the gentle voice and is we need to hear it. So whether it's gentle or thunderous, we need to hear it. We need to be receptive to it. So I was thinking, well, are we ready to really ask a question? You know, are we really ready to ask Manjushri or anything? And are we really ready to hear it? You know, the reality. Do we really want to know? And I could feel, I talked about having these sort of glug moments, you know, when you're like, oh my God, you know, do I really want to know? Would I want to hear, would I really want to hear that thunderous silence? Could I be receptive to that? And I was reading for Buddhism 2 on Monday, there was this thing about being receptive or not. And there's this little story that some of you might know about a Zen master and a university professor. And the university professor goes to the Zen master to ask for a teaching. And the Zen master makes tea, because that's the custom and it's tradition. And he's really hosting this man. And apparently he starts to pour the teas into the cup. And then the cups start to overflow, and they go, you know, and then it starts to go onto the table, and then the professor's sitting there thinking, well, he'd heard of crazy Zen masters before, wondering what's going on. But eventually he says, what are you doing? And the Zen master looked up and said, why are you here? Your cup is full. Unless you empty your cup, you cannot receive anything. No use expecting me to fill your full cup. And I just thought, oh, that's really fascinating. I find it really sort of pokey and challenging. But yet, you know, do we really hear? You know, do we really, can we really listen? Are we open to something new, something we don't know yet? You know, what gets in the way of that? And maybe, you know, Manjushri can help us with this. And opening up takes courage, doesn't it? I can get daunted, like I was saying, like these glug moments. I was a bit daunted, you know. To be open and to hear the teachings, these perfection of wisdom teachings or other Dharma teachings, you've got to be prepared to be challenged and to change, you know. And I think that's what's being asked here. And I was thinking, well, all the time the truth is available to us. This is what we're told, isn't it? It's all the time. Manjushri, this wisdom, is there. The reality is there. It's available to us all of the time. And it's just, can we tune in? Can we really be receptive? Can we listen? And I was thinking for myself, I was thinking sometimes I think with the Manjigosha, this gentle voice, I could relate to it. I was thinking like sometimes it's like I can just sort of hear it in me or something, like the truth. You know, if I'm reflecting on something or in meditation, like all things are just a flow, you know, and there's no substance, there's nothing fixed here. And I can feel it sort of quietly coming through and, you know, can I, you know, tune into it a bit more or something. Or sometimes you can suddenly have a breakthrough, you know, sort of a moment of, maybe this is more like the thunderous, something erupts into your consciousness. There's an insight or something in your experience and it's a bit like a breaking through or cutting through. Suddenly something, some level falls away of delusion or something like that. And of course there's many more to go, but it's like sometimes that can happen. I was just thinking about that in my own experience. And we could notice, couldn't we, if we could sort of hear the truth, sort of, maybe it's a bit in the background. Can we bring it a bit more into the foreground? Yeah, and I just wrote again, when writing this bit, you know, when I was writing this and I was thinking about it, I was thinking, gosh, it's so challenging. That Manjigosha is always there. I can always listen. Can I hear it? Can I be receptive? You know, so these are questions I was asking myself. And then I started thinking, so we're sort of moving now into, well, how do we do it? So how are we to transform ignorance? How do we do this? What do we do? And what I realised I have been doing, and what I'm trying to do more of, is practising in the three levels of wisdom. So I was just thinking how they apply to this. So there's the wisdom through hearing, hearing the Dharma through listening or reading. You hear it, you hear the Dharma. And I guess, you know, just really trying to hear it, just to listen. And maybe we're trying to listen to Manjigosha's quiet voice. Or we read the Dharma, so there's this level of wisdom. And then there's the level of thinking about it. And I think when you do a talk, it really takes you into this level. So the wisdom you think about what you've heard or about what you've read, you reflect. And more of practice for me has been turning it over. You know, you can walk along and turn over in your mind a thought or a Dharma, a piece of Dharma or something. You think about it, you ask yourself questions. Is it true? You know, is it really true? And then that takes it to another level. You know, it starts to take it to another level. It starts to, you know, be something you're really sort of owning, taking on. And then there's you move into the wisdom of meditation, but contemplative, contemplating. In meditation, in deep meditation, we start to talk about then moving into like insight practice and vipassana. Trying to see within your experience, really touching your own experience, the truth. And this is, I think, the knowing it in your bones. It's like, we're just trying to take it through all those levels. And I can notice through just thinking a lot about Manjigosha what an effect it's having on my experience, and then the next level is just to take it much more into meditation and contemplate what Manjigosha is communicating. So the Heart Sutra, I'll just sort of come to that, so because that's probably the perfection of wisdom text that we're most familiar with. And I was thinking about when I first heard that many, many years ago when I first started coming along. And I thought, whatever is it? You know, what is this about, the Heart Sutra? But I was intrigued. You know, it's like, God, it's communicating something, but what is it? Couldn't understand it, and yet. And So more and more I've tried to, you know, and especially as I've been thinking doing this talk, just saying that, you know, reciting the Heart Sutra much more often in my own personal practice. And just contemplating it more, just taking it in, seeing what it communicates. So I was thinking, you know, we can do this, we can practice these levels of wisdom at any time, you know, and just keep taking them deeper and deeper. It could be the Heart Sutra, it could be writings on conditionality, it could be the first verses of the Dhammapada. You know this thing about, let's say, have a tiny piece of Dharma and really know it or something. I was thinking it's sort of that. And so through that whole process, out of knowing the truth, we start to move to knowing that all phenomena are shunyata. We're starting to try and move in that direction. And for Manjugosha, of course, knowing that truth, all phenomena, all dharmas, everything is shunyata. Knowing that, I was thinking of the verse in the Heart Sutra about... rid of delusive hindrance. Is that how it goes? Rid of delusive hindrance. Rid of
freed
of delusive hindrance. Rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clear as nirvana. That's what sort of came to mind. And I was thinking, yes, of course, Manjugoshi's freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it. And this is like, you know, this sword who can just cut through delusion just like that. And then, of course, then all the communication from Manjugosha is Dharma. And I was thinking every word is gentle or there's this thunderous, silent quality to it. And the truth will be communicated in ways that everyone can hear. You know, if we can listen. Everyone who can listen will hear. There's no self-sense, no clinging to anything. And I was thinking of the gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisvaha. So this gone beyond, entirely and utterly gone beyond. You know, I was just thinking that that's where Manjugosha is trying to take us. So I thought I'd end by just reading the Heart Sutra to us. And we could just sit and close our eyes if you wish, and I'll just read the Heart Sutra. The Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. Here then, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself, are the same as this. All things are by nature void, they are not born or destroyed. Nor are they stained or pure, nor do they wax or wane. So, in emptiness, no form, no feeling, thought or choice, nor is there consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No colour, sound, smell, taste, touch, or what the mind takes hold of, nor even act of sensing. No ignorance or end of it, nor all that comes of ignorance. No withering, no death, no end of them. Nor is there pain or cause of pain, or cease in pain or noble path to lead from pain. Not even wisdom to attain. Attainment too is emptiness. So know that the Bodhisattva, holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in pranya wisdom, is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. All Buddhas of past and present, Buddhas of future time, using this pranya wisdom, come to full and perfect vision. Hear then the great Dharani, the radiant peerless mantra, the pranya paramita, whose words allay all pain. Hear and believe its truth. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhiswaha. Thank you.